Group meeting, Saturday, 12th March, 1983. Our concern has always been the living of the religious life. We are not interested in comparing religions one with another, because it is, as I said, a hateful and a stupid thing to do. Hateful because the comparing of religions has led to this extraordinary idea that one's own belief and religion is superior to others, and the phenomena of militant evangelism, and worst of all, so many wars and cruelties in the name of religion have absolutely desecrated human history. So out with this false type of comparing religions. And it is stupid, utterly stupid, simply because that which belongs to the realm of transcendence, whose context is infinity, eternity, and immortality, has no such thing as comparison in it. The idea of comparing one thing with another belongs to the realm of the finite and the mortal. In the realm of the immortal, you cannot compare. This is the fact, and people have never seen this or understood it. And so throughout the centuries we've had this trouble. But if we are concerned with the living of the religious life in the true sense of the word religious, that is, not to regard it as the opposite of, or a contrast to, or something which is which produces a struggle with the secular life, then we shall be more or less along the right lines. Because when the secular life is lived in the religious spirit, with a truly religious attitude towards everything that we do in the world and that happens in the world, then we are living religiously in the real sense. Because by living in this manner, we relate ourselves rightly to the world as a whole. If we don't relate ourselves or try to relate ourselves rightly to the world as a whole, we do so in terms of relating ourselves to a particular. And if we relate ourselves to a particular in the context of the finite and mortal, where comparison holds good, there will always be conflict, struggle, competition, and all the ordinary horrors that are brought into being because of that. So now, today, I would like to go right into the depths. I'm going to talk right over your heads, deliberately, but I trust right into your hearts, because it is the heart that understands, not the head. The head is a mere computer, a marvelous computer, mind you. Because if all that our own brains can do as a computer, if we were to build a machine to be the equal of it, our machine would be the size of St. Paul's Cathedral approximately. So you see what marvelous nuts we all have. Really wonderful. And as a matter of fact, they are really wonderful. The average brain contains 100 trillion bits of information in order to run this little system called the human body. 100 trillion bits of information. And if all those bits of information were written out, were printed in full, in short, succinct form, it would take about 20 million volumes. You may well ask, why on earth do you have so many books around you when you've got 20 million inside your head? But that is how it is. So you see, the brain is not to be despised by any means. But the brain is not the instrument of understanding in depth in that manner which enables us to live the religious life, to maintain our activity in the course of living the religious life, you see, and informing all the right relationships with everyone and with everything. So it is the heart which is important. Now, you have all heard me, excepting those who have come for the first time, you have all heard me use the word transcendence over and over again. I use that word instead of using a word like God or Brahman or Ahura Mazda or Allah or something like that, for the very simple reason that those words are heavily loaded with particular meanings that the world has applied to them for, well, practically up to 40 centuries. You see, they all have specified meanings. And it is this specified meaning which spoils the effectiveness and the power of the word and its transcendent significance. It's all lost. Our words are like a prison house for the ultimate reality as such. Therefore, I use the word transcendence, which in course of time will also become loaded and will fail to serve its proper purpose. However, it will do for the present. If we are concerned with transcendence, we must be wise enough not to strive to attain or achieve transcendence. That is quite impossible. No one can do it. People delude themselves that they can. And they are, you can come across people who will quite sincerely and absurdly say, God spoke to me, I have spoken with God. You see, and of course they speak either Dutch or Hindi or whatever it is. Well, I'm absolutely certain that God does not speak either Dutch or Hindi. God talks in a manner which your Dutchman or Hindu doesn't know when he says that he speaks with God. So, we have to appreciate the context of transcendence as such. It is transcendence which realizes itself as transcendence and as the perfected human through each and every one of us who lives the religious life. There are no hard and fast rules about how to live the religious life. The art of living the religious life is very much like what happens to the living body once you are born, when it lives. How does your body live? It lives. Do you know how it lives? The process of life, the living process, which makes the newborn infant grow to adulthood and manhood and womanhood. We don't know. Life does it all by itself in the most extraordinary way. Now, ordinarily, we would say that life does that unconsciously. Far from it. To me, that process of life, which finds itself in free expression in terms of continuous action, which is progressive and which is growth, the emergence into the new and the wonderful, is the real meaning of consciousness. Consciousness come to fruition is action in terms of utter freedom, perfect spiritual freedom, which has no relationship whatsoever to the common misconception of human beings. Freedom means I can do what I like. You certainly cannot do what you like. Try it and see what happens in the world. All the world has been doing it for the last 3 or 4 million years and not being particularly happy about it in consequence. So we must avoid that, you see. All right. This context of transcendence, which we call infinity, eternity, and immortality. What do these things mean? What is their significance? The fact of the matter is you cannot define infinity in positive terms. The only real conception of infinity we humans can have at our stage of development is that it is not finite. All the words which belong to the transcendent context, and there are very few, about a dozen or a score only, they negate that which all the words which belong to the finite and mortal context. Take the word immortality. It is non-mortality. Just as in relation to death, it is deathlessness rather than anything else, you see. And the same with time and eternity. But the words which represent the transcendent context completely subsume the finite and mortal context. Because the finite and mortal context is an expression in limitation, in constriction of the transcendent and the immortal, the infinite and the eternal. Now, our consciousness has not yet awakened to sufficiently to enable us to be truly conscious of infinity and of eternity. When the individual human being realizes complete fulfillment as the true human, then he is able to be conscious in terms of infinity and eternity. Now, take this word infinity. When we say infinity, almost always we immediately think of something tremendously large. We associate size with infinity. We associate measurement with infinity. That is to say, in the negative sense, you cannot measure infinity. So actually, size, shape, measurement, contrasts, this, that, and the other, and so forth, they all disappear. Now you see, these are words which I utter. If you merely think about them, then you won't even begin to be conscious in terms of infinity. Don't think about the negation of the finite and all the words which belong to the finite. Don't think about them, because thought only deals with that which belongs to the realm of the finite, and the thought is produced out of the brain and the conditioning of the brain and all the knowledge and information and experience we have gathered, which is all stored up there, you see. So don't think about it. Just let the idea of size, shape, measurement, contrasts, just let them all disappear. Try and feel what it is to be shapeless, to be without any size, to have no this or that, no here or there. Obviously, since infinity essentially belongs to space, to spatial to the spatial consciousness, the here and the there disappear altogether. There is only nowhere and everywhere. And nowhere and everywhere are identical, because the moment you particularize a where, then you have immediately set up limitations. But if you are truly conscious in terms of infinity, then there are no limitations whatsoever. So you see, the brain can't think this out. But you can feel it, you can sense it. If you just let the brain be quiet, let the word be there, because the word infinity be there, because the word is the sort of stimulating agent. You see? And if it successfully stimulates your innermost consciousness, you will begin to be conscious of the significance and the implications of infinity. Some of the implications I've already told you. Size, shape, measurement, etc., they all disappear. You see? Now, we are conscious, or in the ordinary way, through the functioning of our senses and our brains. Now, when we are limited to that kind of consciousness, which is present only because of the functioning of the sense organs and the activity of the brain. But that functioning and activity constricts mind in its reality. Mind in its reality, its totality, is universal. It is infinite. It doesn't belong to anyone. It doesn't lodge as such inside any organism as such. It works through the organism only when the psyche is utterly purified. Then this universal energy functions freely through the brain of that person. Otherwise it doesn't. It can't. So, with sense and brain functioning, mind is constricted, and consciousness is darkened. Note carefully, both these, mind and consciousness, are universal. They are not particular. We misuse the language because out of our ignorance we say, my mind, my consciousness. There's no such thing. My momentary awareness, unfortunately there isn't another word which is good enough to express the nature of consciousness as it functions in its constricted state, in its darkened state. Now, if one can really respond, not react, but respond to this, and see and begin to feel the fact, feel it with your heart, not of course the physical heart, but heart in the sense of the essence of mind within you. See this Sanskrit word hridaya, which means the heart. Shankaran, you can contradict me if I'm wrong. Which means the heart, means the very essence of the thing. For instance, we use the phrase the heart of the matter. You see, the absolute essence of it, which usually is nondescript. It is a felt thing which goes right into one's inner consciousness. That is the heart of the thing. All right. Now, if we appreciate what I've just said about the senses and the brain being restrictive agents, where our relationship and contact with transcendence is concerned, the statements that the world is a magic show, a bubble, a lightning flash, the gleam of a firefly, an illusion. You will see how true they are. You know, you get this sort of statement in Mahayana Buddhism. You get it in Shankara's doctrines and the similar doctrines in India. And I think the Kabbalistic teaching also has something quite similar to it, you see. Now, let us spend a few minutes in connection with the word eternity. I have said during the past few years that eternity is not endless time, nor is it timelessness. Time we know only in unidirectional terms. Time begins, is now, and moves into the future. An endless past and an endless future do not constitute eternity at all. Time is a mode of consciousness. Time is actually the rhythm of the living process of the entire universe, including us. That is time. It's the rhythm of the living process of the universe. We have manufactured machines to measure time. Our consciousness already constricts eternity sufficiently to make us aware in terms of time only. And then we go and make machines which constricts time to the very mechanical tick-tock, tick-tock of the second and so forth. Nor is it to be identified with timelessness. I think I am contradicting every other person who has talked about this matter, because they have always identified timelessness with eternity. Timelessness is an experience which you, the finite mortal, can have. When you are dancing with the one and only, the special one, from 10 in the evening till 5 o'clock in the morning, and you look at your watch and say, my God, what's happened to the time? You've been in a timeless condition. But that is like a state of obliviousness, a state of intoxication where time is concerned. Then there is the yogi, the meditator, who enters into the deeper state of consciousness, which in Buddhist terms we call the cessation, in Vedantic terms we call the Turiya state, in Christian terms the Unio Mystica, the real Unio Mystica, not this temporary flash business which so many Christian mystics have talked of. That is timelessness, but that happens at a particular moment in time when the whole organism is very, very quiet, intensely sensitive, and completely receptive to the influence of the power of transcendence, functioning, just touching you. The lightning of transcendence touches you. And you have this experience of timelessness. But you may be in that state up to 7 days, maybe. 7 days and nights without the body moving at all. But then at the end of the 7 days, you have to come out of it. As long as there is the body, you can't stay longer than that, because the body has to eat, it has to eliminate, it has to rest, etc., etc., you see. So timelessness is bounded by time, and as such, I wouldn't identify it with eternity. The sense of eternity is rather more difficult to thrill to than the sense of infinity. One of the difficulties is that the brain is so accustomed to think of eternity as endless time that we get this sort of spatial idea of a unidirectional movement. an endless unidirectional movement. There is no movement at all in eternity. Eternity, to eternity belongs the word immutable. But although it is immutable, it is active. It is action of a nature which utterly defeats the brain from understanding, from grasping. Utterly defeats it. I mentioned this action of consciousness in perfect freedom. That when consciousness comes to ultimate fruition, it is pure action in absolute freedom. A freedom whose meaning we don't know. So, eternity, where eternity is concerned, all our psychical states vanish. Every one of them. Because all our psychical states are dominated, as far as their manifestation and expression is concerned, they are dominated by time, the movement of time, of the living process of the universe as such. Change, growth, development, attainment, achievement, fulfillment, all vanish where eternity is concerned. None of these things apply to the context of eternity. They can't, if you think of it. Not if you think of it, if you can sort of somehow vibrate in tune with it. To use the Pali word vijnana, vijnana is completely disappears. Vijnana belongs to the realm of the finite and mortal. When vijnana disappears, it is utterly transformed into this immutable, which is vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato paham pabam. Or paham. Both words apply. Consciousness, which is without any characteristics. When we ordinarily use the word mind, we always think of characteristics. He has got a brilliant mind, he's got a mathematical mind, and all that sort of thing, don't we? Actually, his brain is like that. Not his. He hasn't got a mind of his own, apart from his bad tempers and so forth. Without characteristics, this is the important thing. All characteristics that we apply to God or transcendence and so forth is our mistake. We are only projecting ourselves in apotheosis and saying this is God, which is nonsense, isn't it? This one can think out logically. All right. Anidassanam, that means without characteristics. Anantam, endless. If it is endless, it is also beginningless. And therefore, there is no question of an origin where consciousness is concerned. It is. And then, unfortunately, we can't avoid it. It's so easy to do it. We say, it is so everlastingly. Now, everlastingly is a time concept. It doesn't belong to eternity. It is everlasting and it is also not everlasting at the same time. Anantam, endless, yes. Sabbato, everywhere, pabam. Means shining, or pahang, meaning accessible. The Buddha uses both words. In the Majjhima, he uses pahang. In the Digha, it is pabang. Now this, to me, is definitely the equivalent, the exact equivalent of the Hindu Atma, the Upanishadic Atma. It is precisely that. That's how it is talked of. Mind you, all these words are merely for the purpose of suggestion, not of saying that it is so, just like that. When we deal with transcendence, or that which is utterly beyond the finite and the mortal, we cannot and should not attempt to categorize, you see, to pigeonhole things. You simply cannot. Strict logic, which is so dear to human beings who deal with pure science and philosophy, restrictive philosophy, not true philosophy, but restrictive philosophy. They want to categorize everything. They want to pigeonhole everything. And therefore, they want everything to fit in logically, which means according to the words which they themselves use and define. Every word has a definition, isn't it? It's finite, it is temporal, it is mortal. Whatsoever is temporal is mortal, because it begins and dies. So now, it is the exact equivalent of Atma. I think in Zarathustrianism we have the word Fravashi to represent that state of being. And as an attribute or a power of Ahura Mazda, which is the Zarathustrian term for God, Ahura Mazda, Lord of life and wisdom. Lord of life and wisdom. The term is Vahu Mano, the good mind. The word good meaning the absolutely perfect mind, the mind which is utterly without any flaws or possibility of mistakes. It is the omniscient mind in the true sense of the word. So now, when one has been through the necessary purification and can begin to sense infinity and eternity, then pure mind, enlightened consciousness functions. Remember I said that with our confinement to the senses and the brain, mind is constricted and consciousness is darkened. When that constriction and darkening disappears, then the enlightened consciousness functions. And that enlightened consciousness, because of its enlightenment, negates everything that belongs to the finite and mortal, but it does not destroy it. This is a very important point to bear in mind, that in the Aeonian evolutionary process, out of the mud, if you like, or the clay of ignorance and shortcomings and so forth, the ascent to the transcendent heights of human perfection, the whole process is one of enlightenment, an awakening of consciousness. You know that modern science is beginning to sort of very tentatively and cautiously grope into this realm of consciousness existing in everything and everywhere. And that is a fact. That is a fact which those old people 35 centuries ago, 40 centuries ago, they did in their way know. They touched this significance and the implications of infinity and eternity. And so the religious consciousness had come to full fruition in them. Now, when pure mind and enlightened consciousness function freely through you, the finite, mortal, psychophysical organism, then shape and form return. But you, the perfected Holy One, the full-fledged human, remain out of prison. You are no longer imprisoned by any conditioning, by any limitations. You realize, that is, make real. To realize means to make real, to make the uttermost truth that is possible for us at our level in this world as such. You realize that statement in the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. I have suggested some of the things which contribute towards the emptiness of infinity and eternity. All those things are out, you see. It's a void, but it's a void which holds the entire plenitude in potential. Potentially holds the entire plenitude, because the creative, primordial creative energy, in the process of its manifestation through grades and grades of being and awareness, becomes increasingly constricted, more and more, and finally ends up with the world as we know it, the universe as we know it, solid, liquid, gaseous, and the different forms of energy that science has been able to investigate and control and utilize, unfortunately sometimes in a very destructive way. This conquest of nature idea has been one of the most damnable ideas that has seized man's mind. You do not conquer nature. You never will conquer nature. Nature is Mrs. God. And that's that. If you try to conquer her, you'll get eaten up ultimately. So you realize form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And you also realize samsara, that is the succession of lives and deaths. I prefer to put it in these terms, the succession of conditioned states. Jati, I think, really means the conditioned state. That meaning is regarded as a secondary meaning in the dictionaries and so forth. And the primary meaning is birth. Actually, the moment that you find this in the Mahasuddhasana, Mahasuddhasana Jataka, I think you find it there. King Mahasuddhasana talks to his wife, his queen, and says to her, birth, as soon as there is birth, there is a state, a conditioned state. And the moment there is a conditioned state, there is the process of moving on towards death. And that moving on towards death is a road of sorrow and suffering and misery. And it's not only sorrow and suffering and misery as we ordinarily know it, illness, loss, and all the rest of the claptrap of earthly life, you see. But it is also, it includes that greatest of all sorrows and sufferings, which we must not run away from, because that is the road to a fulfillment, the awareness that we are isolatively self-conscious, separate from the transcendent reality. We are divorced from it. God is, see how we have sentenced God to heaven and the devil to hell. And they're both such nice chaps. If only you knew. So samsara and nirvana are an identity. So the purpose, thereby the purpose of your existence is fulfilled in the world's eyes. Fulfillment means nothing. Fulfillment means no thing to the Buddha mind, to the Christ consciousness. It means no thing. And then the Holy One, the perfected Holy One says, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Otherwise he mustn't say it. Unfortunately, there are too many of our countrymen who go about trumpeting like mad elephants, not like good elephants, you see, trumpeting Aham Brahmasmi and so forth, and they say, oh, this chap is in Nirvikalpa Samadhi 24 hours all the day, every day of his life, which is utter nonsense, because the nature of the physical body is such that it prevents definitely a Nirvikalpa Samadhi for 24 hours throughout the day, all the days of your life, in the real sense of the Nirvikalpa Samadhi. There is the statement, to use the phrase, the Christian phrase, I and the Father are one. The Father in heaven is the Buddha mind, the Christ consciousness. Abba in Chokhmah. That is what the Father in heaven is. It is consciousness functioning through you in the supreme state, the supreme meditative state. And that is the sort of culmination of the life of the yogi and of religious living. What has happened to the organism is that isolative separativeness, this self-consciousness which is isolative, I am I and not anything else or any other person. I the self am the self and all the rest, the universe, is the not-self. This kind of awareness is what absolutely damns our lives and spoils them. But that isolative self-consciousness is completely annihilated in the realization of infinity and eternity.